Thank you for the invitation. It's always good to be back at Perimeter. So what I want to tell you today is a little bit about a paper that came out last week with Haishan Liu and Chris Pope from A&M and Hong Lu, who's in Beijing. This is a paper that has, I think, interesting results, but also a lot of open questions and things we don't understand 100%, so I would like to get as much feedback from you guys as possible, especially because I know some of you have been working on these things for a while. So I'll try to keep it rather basic, not go into the details. And I know that we have a bit of a mixed audience, so I'll start with a simple reminder of the type of scaling geometries that I'm going to be interested in. But for at least the end of the talk, I really want to focus on not just the features that we saw, but also a number of open questions. So as you well know, there has been a lot of work on trying to understand phases that are anomalous, strongly coupled phases, using gravitational theories. That's why we're all here. And a lot of the effort recently has really been on understanding the breaking of a number of symmetries, ground states, instabilities, and so on. And I've spent a few years, or at least a couple of years at least, trying to understand some of the properties of certain geometries that happen to be non-relativistic in some energy scale, and also exhibit what is called hyperscaling violation, which we heard of from John a few minutes ago. And there is a very interesting story, and there's a rich structure, if you like, that has to do with the instabilities and the ground states of these types of solutions. So if you take solutions that are non-relativistic and have hyperscaling violation, turns out that they suffer from a number of instabilities, superfluid, striped, and they can go down to a number of phases. If you think of this as being valid in some intermediate energy scale. But I'm not going to talk about that today. What I really want to talk about is a simple model where we looked at some the behavior of the conductive properties of a system. And we're really building on a lot of work by a bunch of people in this room and others that will come a little bit later. But our main question was to try to generalize some of the existing models, allow for additional scales in the system, and extract some information analytically about the types of behaviors that we can see. So what I'll talk about is a four-dimensional gravitational model that you can think of as being either embedded in Lipschitz asymptotics. That's what we did. We took some non-relativistic hyperscaling violating geometries that are non-relativistic even in the UV, and I'll tell you a little bit more about what they are. But I want you to keep in mind throughout this talk that the same IR information would be there if you constructed these geometries by going to an ADS UV. So if this is the UV of the theory, the reason we are really focusing on that is because we can find analytical solutions that, as you know, is very useful, even in the presence of momentum dissipation. But alternatively, you could slightly modify the theory, modify it appropriately in the UV, and then you would be able to construct numerically flows that go to a relativistic theory. So I want you to keep that in the back of your mind. OK, so let me just remind you, although we already heard of it from John, let me just remind you a little bit about what we mean by hyperscaling violating. We are all familiar with the dynamical critical component that simply tells you that you have theories in which time and space can scale differently. And of course, as a consequence of that, you would have a modified dispersion relation. But there is an additional exponent that's called hyperscaling violation that is a measure of the fact that the free energy in the system can be anomalous. So it's parametrizing an anomalous scaling of the free energy. And it also tells you that the critical excitations in the system live in some reduced number of dimensions. So if your system has, say, d field theory dimensions, or actually, right, depending on the number of dimensions of the field theory, what you find is that the if you are in a system with hyperscaling violation, the critical excitations appear to be living in d minus theta number of spatial dimensions. So it's just telling you that you have an anomalous scaling of the energy density of the free energy. In particular, if you have theories in which you have this type of scalings, of course, all your two-point functions, correlation functions, will exhibit such scalings. And as an example, as we saw a few minutes ago, the behavior of the entropy as a function of temperature will then be very sensitive to the presence of hyperscaling violation, as well as the dynamical critical exponent. So I know you're all, you know, you've seen this before, but maybe some of you might not have seen how you geometrize these type of scalings. So you could ask, how do they arise from the geometry? So imagine that you take a metric of this form. These spatial dimensions, this is in D plus two dimensions. So you can check that if you scale time and space in this way, and you also send, in this coordinate system, you send R to R divided by your scaling lambda. In a theory in which you have no hyperscaling violations, this would be a symmetry. So the Lipschitz symmetry is an exact symmetry of this geometry, and the action is invariant. On the other hand, the role of the hyperscaling violation is to break that. And under that transformation, the metric will actually scale. And you'll find that the length, your line interval, will now scale with the power of this hyperscaling violating exponent. So again, this is telling you that there's some amount of, there's an anomalous behavior of the free energy that you can also see from the point of view of the metric. So I'm assuming most of you have seen this, but if you haven't, this is the way in which you would geometrize it. Now, you can ask, what type of theories give rise to such solutions? There are a number of gravitational theories in which you can get them, at least in some part of the geometry. But you could also ask me, what is the minimal model? In other words, what are the least number of ingredients that will give you that as an exact solution everywhere in the geometry? And then those models are pretty simple. They involve, in addition to gravity, a single U1 gauge field and a scalar. So let me just quickly tell you what they look like, just so you can get a little bit of a feel for the ones that I will talk about. There are generalizations of this.
Can I ask a quick question before you continue? So if I'm being very naive and I look at this metric, I would just say it's odd that S has different dimensions.
Well, that's exactly how, and that's exactly related to the fact that the free energy in the system is not scaling.
Precisely, but from some classical solution, is there some meaning?
I mean, the equations of motions are still invariant. So the equations of motion are invariant. It's just that the solution is a scaling covariant and it's not invariant.
Yeah, I mean, I guess Ingo,
is if there's an extra scale that you can forget about in your effective IR theory, but if you really wanted to recover vanilla dimensional analysis, you really have to reinstate that scale.
Okay. Well, another thing. I'll mention it now, just in case it's related. There's also an additional exponent that I could have talked about, which is called the conduction exponent, introduced by Blaise as well as other people. So you can also have an anomalous scaling of the gauge field or the charge density, which would be a similar story. So even there, equations of motion are invariant, but you do have this charge density that's not scaling with the naive number of dimensions. And I'll come back to that later. Okay, so here is a simple model that will give you that particular gravitational metric as an exact solution. So gravity coupled to a scalar coupled to a U1 gauge field. And then, so this would be enough to get the Lifshitz metric with the hyperscaling violation set to zero. But if you want to have hyperscaling violation, then you should allow for some potential, and a simple, a single exponential will do the job. So this is a simple model where you would get those solutions as exact solutions. And one thing that's interesting is that they're supported by a scalar that runs logarithmically. So this is not, there's this, the running of the scalar is breaking the exact Lifshitz symmetry of the solution, okay? But anyway, so there's been a lot of work on this type of models, as well as ways in which you can modify them to recover all sorts of very interesting flows in which this type of scaling geometries arise, maybe as intermediate geometries, and then are UV completed in ADS or not, depending on how you choose things. Okay, there's been a lot of work on that, and also on the type of IR behavior. So the model that we looked at is a little bit more complicated, but it's roughly the same idea. So we built on this by adding another gauge field, and then we included some axionic scalars to encode the amount of momentum dissipation, and I'll get back to that in a second. But let me just redraw the picture that I had a minute ago here, just to emphasize this idea that, so we are looking at solutions that are non-relativistic at all energy scales, but really you could build solutions that are asymptotically to the anti-de-Sitter by modifying the equivalent of this action and adding appropriate terms here that would force the scalar field, this guy phi, to become constant, settle to a constant at the UV. So you can do that, has been done for this type of models by a bunch of people. It just requires a little bit of numerical work. Okay, so we are insisting on this flow to keep solutions analytic. And also because it is interesting to ask, how would the story change if you have a non-relativistic tiering in the UV? And as you know, a lot of people, or at least there has been interest recently in trying to understand how the holographic dictionary and how it's generalized for theories that are non-relativistic at all energy scales.
So if I compute the Ricci scale, it will be yellow.
Yes, exactly. That's precise. Yes, the Ricci scale in this theory is the Ricci scale, one of the curvature invariants, is divergent depending on the sign of theta. So you can have that divergence either in the IR or in the UV, depending on the sign of theta. And that's exactly why, that's one of the reasons why you would expect these geometries to really not be good geometries all the way down to the IR at zero temperature. But finite temperature is fine. That's one way to resolve it. At zero temperature, there are many papers that show that you can go down to other phases, including
ones that can be embedded in top-down models.
Yes.
The problem is in IR.
So
depends on the sign of log R,
yeah, so the top-down models, right, so in the top-down models, you get either, you get geometries in which the IR is either ADS2 cross R2 or conformal to ADS2 cross R2, and so these are really more, or special limits of these solutions for infinite Z and infinite theta, where these problems go away. And these really arise more in other parts of the geometry. So we can talk about that afterwards. Yeah. Okay, yeah, so I should say that's important. There are a lot of problems with these solutions. If you take them to be good everywhere, they're not meant to be good everywhere at zero temperature, but at least at finite temperature. So if you turn this into black brains, there's no problem in the IR. Now, for what we want to do, keeping them analytic at all energy scales, it turns out that there is generically a curvature singularity in the UV. So even if the finite temperature takes care of the problem in the IR, there is a curvature singularity in the UV for a certain sign of theta. So we're going to stay away from that choice of the sign of theta and only look at solutions that are well-behaved in the UV. But that's something to keep in mind. That problem would not exist for the ADS completions.
Even when you have the singularity in the IR, if the metric itself makes sense, that is, if there's nothing going the wrong sign or being complex or anything like that, the singularity in the IR is of the good kind. That is, for instance, if you look at the saturation problem around that metric, it doesn't require you to impose extra number of conditions in the IR or stuff like that.
Well, you can put the horizon.
But even if you don't put a horizon, you could work at zero temperature and look at fluctuation. You wouldn't have to impose more boundary conditions than necessary in the other.
But the dilaton is running. I mean, the coupling is blowing up or going to zero. Yeah. So you do expect other completions.
In the region of parameters where the metric doesn't make sense with certain season data, you also see that correspondingly the fluctuation problem is not well defined because you would have to impose extra boundary conditions in the other.
As you're probably aware, in models like that, there are also lots of instabilities when Sarah was mentioning about.
Yeah.
And so those instabilities occur precisely at low temperature. So even though formally you write down the solution, physically it doesn't make sense. Because there is a different phase
that
you would be driven to. So in particular, in the solutions that Jerome Bonfler constructs using this type of discussion, that's exactly what's happening.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, at this point, I should say that so one thing that can happen is you can get striped instabilities.
Yes.
I have a paper on that, and also superfluid instabilities. So there's a nice story, but we'd like to talk about the paper from last week. So, okay, so this is the setup. I know this is pretty basic. So any more questions on this? Okay, so let me tell you a little bit about the model that we looked at. Okay. So our field content, in addition to gravity, we have two gauge fields. They play very different roles. One of them will be responsible for generating the Lipschitz background. What I mean by that in particular is that its charge is fixed in terms of the parameters of the solution. So it's fixed in terms of z and theta. You can't change it. It's not a thermodynamic variable. This guy, instead, is more analogous to the normal Maxwell field in ADS space. So this plays the role of just a standard Maxwell field, except we're not in ADS, we're in the background generated by that guy, and its charge is 3. Okay. We then have a dilatonic scalar that is the analog of that phi. It will also run logarithmically. And finally, we introduce two axions that will be dependent on the spatial coordinates of the boundary. And those will be introduced to break translational invariance on the boundary so that one can get finite conductivities. And I'll come back to that in a minute. But first, let me write down the Lagrangian. It's not particularly enlightening, but it will give you a flavor for the difference between the two models. So we have, again, a potential for the dilatonic scalar is just a simple single exponential. We have this scalar field coupled to the two gauge fields. And then the axions are going to also be coupled to the scalar with the same coupling. Okay, so that's our action. Notice there is a shift symmetry for these two guys, chi1 and chi2. And the guy that's responsible for generating the background, Lipschitz background, is that gauge field. Now, there are black hole or black rain solutions in this theory that generalize the metric that I wrote up there. So let me just tell you what the blackening function looks like so you can get a feeling for the type of temperature that will be associated with these solutions. So here, this was a zero temperature solution, but you can put in a function here, the blackening function that encodes the fact that you now have a horizon. And this function will have the usual mass, which is just an integration constant. plus a term coming from the charge of the second gauge field, some power of R, the radial coordinate of ADS, and then a term that is generated by the presence of the axion. So I'm going to tell you what the profile for the axions is in a second. And you have some numerical constants here that are not important. So the axionic scalars are chosen to be of that type. So alpha is simply telling you the strength of the breaking of translational invariance. So weak translational invariance will be small alpha. So alpha is associated with broken translational invariance. OK, so that is the setup. The only real thing to notice from here is that there's a contribution. There's going to be a contribution from the temperature coming out from these black holes from not only alpha, but also Q2. All right, so this is the setting. Any questions on this before
so I go? That 4 mole alpha bar is for D for 4? No.
Yes, sorry. Thank you. Yes, so little d is 2. So we are in 4 space-time dimensions, yep. OK, so our real interest here was in computing holographically the conductivities, DC conductivities. So there are different ways to do that in holography. The sort of original standard way was to look at correlators of the currents. But there's been a great simplification lately that has come from the idea that as it turns out, there are massless modes that are associated with these currents. Or in other words, there are quantities that are radially independent in the bulk that correspond to the currents. That makes the calculation of these conductivities much, much easier because you can then essentially compute them at any point along the radial flow from the boundary to the horizon. And typically, it's particularly convenient to calculate them at the horizon. Okay. I'm not going to go through that calculation, but there has been a lot of work by various people generalizing these ideas. These go back to the membrane paradigm story and have been refined in the presence of momentum dissipation by a bunch of people, including people here. So let me just mention that the original, the beautiful paper by Iqbal and Liu, 2008, with this story of the membrane paradigm has been extended even in the presence of momentum dissipation, in particular by David Tong and Mike Blake, who's in the audience. And then more recently, this story has been made a little bit more, has been generalized and made more precise by Donos and Gauntlet. So I really don't want to go through the details of the calculation, but there is a beautiful kind of horizon story that allows you to quickly identify the conductivities. Finally, we have now understood that if you want to have finite DC conductivities, in other words, if you don't want the electrons to be sort of pushed infinitely far away and find infinite contributions to the conductivity, you have to break translational invariance or dissipate momentum in some way. So these are all the ingredients that are well known. And in our setup, it's these axionic sources that are going to take care of momentum dissipation. OK. So the perturbations that one has to turn on in this system are perturbations of the metric, perturbation of the TX component of the metric, perturbations of the two gauge fields, and a perturbation of one of the axions. Turns out that that is enough. Everything else can be eliminated by various. There's enough freedom to eliminate the other perturbations. The thing that is a little bit that I don't think was appreciated before in the literature is that in these classes of models, you need to keep both fluctuations of the gauge fields turned on. It's not consistent to turn off one of them. So you have to keep both. And in particular, another thing to remember is that if you set the charge of the Lipschitz gauge field equal to zero, that is the same as going to a theory that is relativistic. So it's not consistent to have Q1 equal to zero and keep non-relativistic solution. Okay.
Chi1 is one of the axioms?
Hmm?
Delta Chi1?
That's the perturbation of one of the axioms.
I mean, typically when you have a varying source and the variable.
We're breaking translational invariance and dissipating momentum. So there's going to be a contribution.
Okay. Yeah. I see. So that's just a reflection.
Yes.
Sorry. I have another question. So where does Q1 enter in the axiom? The axioms have a neutron?
The what?
The axioms, the neutral fields?
The axiom, yes.
The guys.
Yeah.
So where does Q1 enter in the axiom?
Q1, okay, yes, thank you. So all these parameters, so it enters some of these parameters. Now I can't remember exactly how, but yeah, so these Lagrangian parameters are all related to Z, theta, Q1, and so on.
I think it's asking a more simple question. It's just that theoretically, if you choose A1 and B,
yeah.
Q1 is in one of these.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah.
Because you didn't write that one.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, so A1 is going to be Q1 times some power of R and H. So. Is that what you were asking?
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. Thanks. Yeah, I mean, yes, Q1 comes in. Let me think for a second. No, sorry. No. Yeah. Right, sorry. Okay, any other questions? Okay, so I'm not going to go through say much about the perturbation equations, but let me just mention that we're essentially inserting two electric fields in this way. Right, so we're going to have an electric field E1, electric field E2 associated with the two gauge fields. Okay. Now, the crucial step in this kind of calculations that survives even here is the fact that there will be conserved currents. In this case, there will be two conserved currents. From the expressions for those conserved currents, one can solve for a matrix of conductivities, essentially. Now, if we were in ADS, the interpretation would be more straightforward. So what you would find, what you find is a relationship of this form that's basically a generalization of Ohm's law, relating currents, the currents as a response to the electric fields with a proportionality encoding all the conductivities in the system. So in ADS, this is a clear interpretation for the currents. In our case, because we have Lipschitz boundary conditions, the story is more complicated, and that's something I'll come back to later on, but you can still go through this procedure and extract these coefficients, okay? And let me write them down just because they'll come back. I will discuss the temperature dependence of some of them, which is kind of the goal of this program. So let me just tell you what they are, and all these quantities are going to be evaluated at the horizon, so the expressions depend on the size of the horizon, which will then encode the temperature dependence. So I want to write them down because there are some nice features that you can already see from here that have been noted in other constructions. So this is off-diagonal components. That's the first component. And then the final component has this kind of structure. Okay. And again, R0 is the horizon. The size of the horizon is going to be, it's going to encode the temperature dependence in some complicated way that I'll come back to in a second. Okay. So one thing I would like you to note is there are two types of contributions to these quantities. One always depends on the charge and the size of the momentum dissipation, and the other one is independent of both. The other thing I would like you, that of course has been seen in a number of examples. The other thing I would like you to notice is that all these contributions are explicitly dependent on the axionic charges scale in the same way. So in particular, they will scale in the same way as a function of temperature. So this is a little bit similar to what was noticed as an example by Mike and Aristos in a slightly different case where they were looking at a system with an electric field and a magnetic field. Here we have two, you know, there is no magnetic field, but the structure is the same. And so you would anticipate that when you do add a magnetic field, you might have a chance at reproducing things like the temperature dependence of the whole angle, for example, as in addition to the temperature dependence of the resistivity, which for the strange metals is a linear function. So now the way in which momentum dissipation is encoded in these various terms, of course, was understood for ADS, but it's not, at least we don't know exactly how it is encoded in this theory with UV asymptotics or Lifshitz, and that's another thing that we would like to look at. Okay, but now I would like to look at two specific cases just to give you a little bit of a feel for the type of behavior that comes out. So, one thing you could do is set the charge Q2 equal to zero. If you do that, you're only left with this term. And if you look at the temperature dependence of that term, you could then ask in what type of cases could you possibly get things like the linear scaling of the strange metal phase, for example. And we'll see that there are some cases that will give you that. The other case that I will want to look at is one in which we want to set this current J1 to zero. Now, this would be a normal current if we're doing ADS, but again, the identification in the Lifshitz case is a little bit less trivial, and I'll come back to that. But the interesting thing is that in this case, you then get an expression for the DC conductivity that will encode a dependence on both charges as well as the axionic scalars. So you can think of this as generalizing some of the constructions that we have seen where we're introducing an additional scale, Q2. And not only we have an additional scale, but we're separating the dependence that comes from the background from the dependence that comes from that charge. So we really have, you know, one charge telling you what type of Lifshitz background you're generating, and the other one just playing the role of a normal charge or a normal electric field. So there is a little bit more freedom, perhaps, than in some of the other constructions that we have seen. Okay. So when you want to translate these things to temperature dependence, this is in general a complicated story. Temperature dependence, the temperature of these black grains will come with different contributions that will roughly have this form. So you recognize this as the standard Lifshitz scaling, but there are also contributions that will modify the temperature coming from the charge and the axions. So in particular, you can look at various regimes of temperature, and you can, if you want, you can, when this term dominates on the other two, that would correspond to large temperature, large in the sense that you're really suppressing the contributions from those two terms, large depending on the size of alpha and Q2. But in that limit, the temperature will just be proportional to the horizon radius to the right power. But more generally, when you lower the temperature from that large temperature limit, you're going to get contributions first from the axions and then from the charge. And the situation will become a little bit more involved. And you know, to solve this, you really have to do it numerically for specific values of the parameters. But in any case, just for simplicity, imagine that we take this large temperature case, because it's the easiest one. So again, focusing on the case where we only allow for this Q1, you find a dependence of this type. So this will be the leading dependence to the conductivity, followed by subleading terms that we're not considering that will depend, for instance, on alpha in more complicated ways. But already at this level, you could ask, is it possible to find some regime where the conductivity will go like one of the temperature so that the resistivity will be linear? So you can see that there are two possibilities. Of course, this is a very rough analysis because we're only looking at some first approximation. But still, you could get a linear regime from that or that, depending on the choices of z and theta. Now, the thing that is a little bit interesting is that that guy, if you insist that this gives you a linear resistivity, it will fix for you z to be 4/3. That's interesting for a couple of reasons. One of them is the fact that some of you might remember there was a paper about a year and a half ago by Sean and Andreas Karch, where they were looking at, they were trying to nail down the possible values of z, theta, and the conduction exponent that I was mentioning earlier by purely field theoretic arguments, trying to compare their sort of general scaling of those appropriate functions to things like resistivity, the Hall conductivity, and so on. And they came up with this as being the value of z that was needed for that. They also had theta equals zero, and their conduction exponent, which was labeled by big phi, was given by -2/3. Now, we don't have these values, but we have something similar, and I'll tell you why we don't have them in a minute. But it's kind of interesting that the same factor of z equals 4/3 is arising from here. And there's another reason why this is special in this setup. It turns out that some of the perturbations of these gauge fields are actually divergent in the UV for a range of z that goes between 1 and 4/3. So whether that is a sign that one is not taking into account holographic normalization, and one should, of course, that's a possibility. But independently of what is the reason, there's something that seems to be special with the value of z equals 4/3. Yeah?
I mean, in Sean and Andreas' paper, they're basically just saying that this is just fixed by dimensional analysis, right? So is it just that in this case that
well, in this,
you've got some scaling symmetry, this term is fixed by the dimension of the current operator in the bound theory to have that power,
basically? It might be. Maybe it's that simple. But what is a little bit, yeah, it might simply be related to that. But there is, that's a good point.
I'm not sure if they,
but there,
they sort of assume that they don't have multiple scales.
Yes, and she has multiple scales. Okay.
But his argument.
So, I mean, it's not. Maybe it's true, but it's not that obvious.
Okay.
What I
just noticed, like, so when I was playing with this model, that a lot of things worked out to match that paper. I didn't think it was possible. It might be that. I didn't figure it out, but. It might be.
Did it work as you mentioned for the resistivity? And their assumption is that this is giving them the temperature dependence.
Yeah.
But if you have extra scales in your system, then you have to know how the scales articulate with each other.
They were assuming kind of just the only scale.
Yeah, exactly. And here it's not necessarily the only scale.
But I do want to say this might be related, because so essentially what is happening in this UV Lifshitz asymptotics is that something is going wrong in that range. Okay,
yeah.
One of the modes is becoming divergent. So a mode of the Lifshitz gauge field is blowing up. So, and that forces you to set what we call J1 equal to zero. You have to do that or you run into trouble if you have this Lifshitz asymptotics. So this value of 4/3 is kind of like a marginal, right? So it might be related to exactly how the modes are growing up. I don't know, that's another thing that, you know, it's one of the things that I would like to understand. So this is a little bit speculative, but what I can tell you is that at least, you know, there are cases in which you can indeed recover linear resistivity. Also from this guy, you can. So you can immediately see that when z is 4 plus theta, this will go like 1 over temperature. However, it turns out that in this expansion, this term is subleading compared to that. So even if it was linear, it would kind of be masked by the leading temperature dependence. But my point is that this is a very rough analysis. We're not putting in all the pieces that contribute to the temperature. And when you do, you might get a much richer behavior of different possibilities. The other thing I want to say is that in our case, again, we see this problem for these Lifshitz boundary conditions that would not be there if you had ADS. We also have, in our notation, unfortunately in our paper, we use a theta that is opposite to what the rest of the world uses. But to avoid UV singularities, we need to take theta positive, so that also, you know, limits some of the behavior you can get, but this would also be relaxed in ADS. That's why I really want to emphasize that picture I drew earlier, that DIR physics will be the same even if you throw away our Lifshitz boundary conditions. Okay, so for me this was a little bit interesting, but there might be a simple reason behind it, I don't know, but I do think it's worth looking into it. And then I should mention that the subleading behavior, so the leading behavior here, large T, is ruled, dominated by this term. Subleading behavior will depend on the amount of hyperscreen violation, so you might, whether you get, say, a quadratic resistivity at lower temperatures or not, will again depend on the sine of theta and how you choose it. But in ADS, it is certainly possible, okay? So, another thing that's a little bit interesting, just as a simple case, it so happens that when you take, when theta is exactly minus 2z, you can solve for the temperature exactly in terms of the horizon radius. In fact, you find that the temperature is precisely proportional to r naught to the z. And then in that case, you find that both terms scale like 1 over the temperature. So you would get a linear resistivity all the time. That's just one of the various possibilities that you can get. Okay. So in the last 10 minutes, I would like to talk about the other case that I just briefly mentioned. So when you set this J1 to 0, what you would think of as a in ADS, the current associated with the first gauge field, and then you read off the resulting expression for the DC conductivity, what we call sigma 2, that also has some nice features that I would like to get some input from the audience about. So expressed entirely in terms of the horizon radius, the conductivity then has this structure. So you can see explicitly the dependence on the two charges and also dependence on the axions. So this is an explicit example where you do have an additional scale that you don't have in the single charge case, or what I call the single charge case. So you can again expand this around the large temperature limit And given the time, I'm not going to write it down, but depending again on the signs of, yep.
It's completely finite even if you don't break completely.
Yes, that's right. Yes, so this is a fine. Maybe. So that's another thing that's interesting. So here you can smoothly take the limit where the amount of momentum dissipation goes to zero and you still have a finite conductivity. So
Sarah, is this like a linear, is this like, right, some, you're forcing some combination of currents that doesn't carry any currents?
Yes, I think so, yes. Yeah.
Well, or it's like top of R versus kind of.
Right.
But somehow the overall, you're building some linear combination of the field so that somehow the overall charge is effectively zero, something like that. Bless, do you agree with that statement?
No, sorry, say again.
So you're building some linear combination of the gauge field, so its overall charge is effectively, it's like having zero charge density.
I think it's more like, if you just have the usual thermoelectric matrix and you look at the collective heat conductivity at zero electrical current, this has the same features. I think this is more like what I'm saying than taking a specific combination of the gauge fields that doesn't carry any charge.
And I'm a bit confused. So you're putting J1 equals zero?
Yes. Yes, for this particular case. So J1 equals zero, you still.
I put this in relation between E1 and E2.
Yes, exactly.
And then this is sigma 2 is the coefficient formula between J0 and like that electric.
Yeah, so you're kind of integrating out that. Yeah.
So that's why I'm saying that maybe it's a little bit more like computing the heat conductivity at zero electrical current.
Yeah,
where the same thing happens, it's also finite.
So in other words, this connectivity is not any of those.
No, it's not. No, it's not J. It's not this one.
Yeah.
It's essentially coming from integrating out the effect of E1. Yeah. Yes.
So it's not obvious. It's just divergent. That is not
okay. Anyway, I'm running out of time, so let me just say one thing that we found. We kind of stumbled across that at this point we don't really understand, but if so as I said, this, in general, this temperature dependence is quite complicated because you have to invert this relation between the horizon radius and the temperature for arbitrary z theta. That's very hard to do. But we played around with it numerically for a couple of cases, and something kind of interesting came out. Again, when z is 4/3 and theta is 0, but this does not seem to be too much. It doesn't seem to care too much about the value of theta. We find this type of behavior for the resistivity as a function of temperature. So, and of course, we have to fix these charges. So when Q2 over alpha is relatively large, we see something that looks like a linear phase at small temperature, and then it turns around and it decays in a way that is very well described by this Steinhardt-Hart approximation for a semiconductor, which I know absolutely nothing about, but other than the fact that you can parameterize the behavior of the resistivity as a function of temperature for semiconductors by following a simple expression of this form. So the inverse temperature will be related to the resistivity in an expansion of this type. Rho is the resistivity here. You get a linear term, a log of rho, a cubic term, and then quadratic term, which my understanding is that for normal semiconductors, this coefficient is typically suppressed. Well, for us, it's almost the same size as the other ones. So just for completeness, let me tell you what these numbers come out to. So this coefficient D comes out to be 0.2. So it seems that the resistivity is very well approximated by that approximation for a semiconductor. And at low, relatively low temperatures, it's linear. So it's not linear all the way to zero temperature, and I don't think you should trust the zero temperature limit here anyway, but there is a region in which it's linear in temperature. And then it behaves like a semiconductor. So it looks very much like a transition between a metal and a semiconductor. The other thing that we noticed is that as you take Q2 over alpha, take it to be smaller, this linear regime goes away, and you just have this fit to a semiconductor. Now, I really don't know whether this is useful or not, but it does follow that behavior very nicely. So if you have seen this before, or if you think of any reason why this might be interesting, a strong coupling, please let me know, especially given that there's this curious fact that that coefficient is quite sizable in this case, and it's typically small. That's my understanding in, for these type of systems. OK, so I think I have a couple of minutes left, so let me just wrap up. So one thing that we would like to do next is to add a magnetic field and to look at the behavior, the whole angle. Especially in the case where we have the contribution coming from both charges, so that we do have an additional scale to play around with. And of course, the question there is whether we can see both the linear regime for the resistivity and also something like the quadratic dependence of that. So that's kind of a general next step. Another thing that is clearly we don't really understand very well is this physical interpretation of what's happening at the boundary for Lifshitz asymptotics specifically. You know, we need to set, we're kind of required to set that quantity to zero for z in some range. Clearly, this must have a nice explanation, and of course, we did not take into account holographic renormalizations. We did not pay any attention to that story. We really should have. So, better understanding holographic renormalization for Lifshitz asymptotics. And here, of course, they're complicated by the fact that we have hyperscaling violation and also momentum dissipation, but that's a natural thing to ask about. And then there's another comment that I would like to make before I close. Another nice feature of having solutions of this type that are not just scaling or non-relativistic in the IR is the fact that we know we're interested in systems sometimes where these non-trivial anomalous scalings are happening at intermediate energies and intermediate frequencies. So for that reason alone, some setup like this where you have control over the geometry and its scaling even at intermediate energies can be useful. And let me just remind you that, for example, Blaise Chaturmoy Bhattacharya and I, a couple of years ago, looked at another model where we engineered, we were looking at optical conductivity, and again, using some of the scaling solutions that were hyperscaling violating, even at intermediate energies, we engineered that in some intermediate frequency regime. Now, of course, that's just a simple, particular, very constrained example, but it's just giving you a little bit of hope that by playing with these geometries that are truly non-trivial at all, at broader ranges of temperature and energy, we can get closer to understanding how to build in these interesting flows and not just IR physics. So that's it. I'm going to stop here. Thank you.
Any further questions?
Yeah.
Stupid question. Do these results depend on whether NAP is bosonic or fermionic?
Well, here we're not. There are no fermions here. We did not. For these constructions, it's only bosonic degrees of freedom. But that's a good question. But we have not. We've not looked at fermions at this level.
And is there any dependence on space dimension?
Well, there's dependence in space dimensions in the sense of the I would say not qualitatively. Quantitatively, yes, but the main features should survive, yeah, in higher dimensions, or, yeah.
So no lower dimension?
I think in lower dimensions, I think you lose a little bit too much, but yeah. No, no. Do we have any upper screen violating in three? Yeah. Yeah, I suppose, yeah, probably in three you would get similar effects. It depends on what you're looking for, but yeah.
So the linear anti-resistivity you're trying to get, is it known how it scales with momentum breaking?
Oh.
Because here you said you could get it from both of these terms, but one of them.
Yes, yeah, so you're right. So one of them explicitly depends on it and the other one doesn't. Yeah, so I keep in mind that this is really just a leading temperature dependence. So the full, if you look at more carefully, you would have alpha, factors of alpha coming in a lot, in a lot of places. So at this stage, I don't know. This is just a very rough estimate, but we would like to look at it a little bit more carefully.
You know, what the conductivity matrix looks like if you don't create transitional? I mean, like you take a small frequency limit.
No, but that's something that we. No, I don't right now, but that's something that we should be able to do. Yeah.
Any further questions?
In the high temperature behavior, the semiconductor thing is just. Thermally activated.
Yes.
Yeah. And that depends on the fact that there's a gap, I guess. That there's a charge gap.
Mm.
And that's what's in the coefficient of the e to the minus delta over t.
Mm.
But how are you going to get these exponentials?
Yeah,
everything in the geometry is scaling.
Yeah,
I believe you when you say you can fit.
Yeah.
The large temperature behavior with this particular form, but. I'm pretty sure you could equally well fit it with a bunch of powers of t.
Yeah, it might be that it's a fluke and that it looks like it's fitting and it's only for a small regime. I don't know. We're looking at it a little bit more carefully now. But I certainly can't give you an analytical estimate right now. Yeah. So it's possible that it might just be an accident. But
you know exactly what's the function you're plotting. You have an expression.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So,
yeah, but it's.
You can just work out what exactly is the large temperature behavior.
The large temperature behavior, yes,
could
you could do that.
T, right? It's
yeah,
not
you.
Maybe logs or exponentials.
Well, I mean, okay, but then depends on how far down this curve is going to go, right? That depends on where that behavior kicks
you're
in.
You're plotting sigma 2, right?
Hmm?
You're plotting sigma 2.
Yeah, but you're asking about the very, I mean, what you're talking about is a behavior that might kick in at larger temperature.
That's right. But
yeah.
So this is going to be, it's going to depend on the equation of state between the R naught and T.
Yeah.
But there's nothing in there that's going to give you an exponential. Your equation of state is a bunch of powers of R naught equal to T.
Yeah.
So when you invert that, which you probably can't do analytically, you'll still just get powers of T, right?
Yeah, a large T, yes, absolutely, yeah.
Another question, Mark? For the UV singular geometries, does the presence or absence of the singularity correspond to something on the field theory side, like a unitary bound?
Let's see. So this is it's just a difference in sign of theta. So I'm not sure if it's a unitary bound. I don't know. It's I don't think so. I think energy conditions are, it's my, yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. Yeah.
Let me guess, maybe a related question. If you calculate the frequency dependence of the conductivity.
Yeah, which we haven't done, but yes, if you could.
Yeah. So would you expect to see different high frequency behavior?
Different high frequency behavior. No, well, I guess you mean for fixed, you mean as a function of z and theta?
Yeah.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. So, that,
so would something sick happen if you picked the wrong side now?
Yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah. Yeah.
Actually, in ADS asymptotics, as long as the geometry makes sense, the background geometry makes sense, the power of the frequency is always of the right side.
Yeah, but they were asking about Lifshitz.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. At least in ADS, there's enough consistency conditions in the background that the two-point function of the current is always different.
Mm-hmm.
With the Lifshitz asymptotics, it's a different story.
Okay.
Maybe that's a good place to stop. Thank you again.
Thanks.